back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We're taking the show on the road, the Maryland Crab Cake Tour, out and about. It's all brought to you by the Maryland Lottery in conjunction with our friends at Goodwill Industries and Window Nation. It's been a long time since I've had any real other than hanging out in the coffee shop and saying hello and fist bumping this guy. I once worked with him 3.5 decades ago, watching him and Rafael Alvarez run around the newsroom up on the fifth floor at 501 North Calvert Street. Don, first off, it's a bucket list thing to have David Simon on the program. You know this. Now, John Waters and my life is complete, Simon. I'll tell you right now.
David Simon, how's that feel? You're in the company. You're John Waters and David Simon. That was Nestor's bucket list. I don't know what the hell that says about his bucket list.
You know, get out of the entertainment industry. Cast a wider net.
Well, I have a gift for you because I love you on Twitter. I love everything about it because it's everything I would always want to do. I have this. I've had this for like 30 years. It's a book of insults called Maledicta. It's like professional work here. I mean, I'm talking about an insult calendar, all sorts of things here that I kept for you and figuring somewhere in here there'd be a gem for you to use on Twitter. A new word, just something new.
There was an academic journal, a very serious academic journal of insulting language. That was titled Maledicta. I would like to say I was a subscriber, but I was not. But a friend of mine was, and it was rather boring. I mean,
the knowledge needs to be executed. Yeah. You know,
well, once you turn anything into an academic discipline, it kind of loses its joie de vivre.
Well, yours feels like that kind of pursuit from the outside. it's an art form. That's all I'm saying.
David, there is so we could talk for hours and we have 30 minutes. I want to start at the beginning for you because most people know a bit of your bio. You were a beat reporter. You were really into the crime coverage. You were Justin Fenton before Justin, and you and Justin now have been reunited in We Own This City. Talk about your journey as a transition from Sun beat crime reporter to this writer, executive, producer, Emmy award-winning person. How does that evolve in the world of David Simon?
It was largely an accident. The pivot was really, I wrote a couple of books when I was a reporter. I went out on leave and I wrote a book called Homicide and another one called The Corner. And they both got made into television. I had more to do with the latter than the former. The former really is the work of Barry Levinson and Tom Fontana, who bought my book and brought it to Baltimore and made it into the NBC show Homicide. And it was on that show I learned how to write a television script. And I started to get some experience about what it meant to shepherd an hour of television into production. And I really, even as I was learning that, I wasn't really serious about leaving journalism. I thought, well, this is an interesting skill set to learn while I'm out on leave trying to finish my second book. You know, I was trying to finish The Corner, and I thought, well, I'll do this because it pays really well. You know, the script, two scripts, you made as much as you made working all year at the Baltimore Sun. So I thought, well, this can augment my salary, and I'll dabble in it a little bit. But I thought I was going to finish the second book, and at that point, I'd taken a buyout from the Sun because they were buying people out.
Out of three of us have done that on this program,
right? I mean, they were beginning to shed personnel, even, and this was a time of great profit in the newspaper industry. They were just taking profits by reducing costs. But I had sort of standing offer from the Washington Post, so I thought, well, I'll do this while I finish my second book, but then I'm going to go be a newspaper reporter again. And then when the second book was done, the opportunity to make it into a miniseries at HBO opened up, and I did that. And then HBO said, well, what else do you have? Do you have anything that might be a continuing series? And Ed Burns and I thought about constructing something that ultimately became The Wire. And pretty soon, 3 or 4 or 5 years had passed by and I hadn't gone back to a newspaper. And it was, you know, I was starting to have to admit that maybe I wasn't going to be a newspaperman anymore. I was going to write television and produce television. I really backed into it. There was not a consistent plan. I mean, I never went to film school, you know what I mean? I mean, there was no real plan other than it happened.
Did you feel qualified the day they brought you in? Did you feel a little like, you know, might not like it, right? I mean, you probably, you know, I know you'd be relatively cynical. I'm not sure you thought you'd like it, right?
I didn't think it was going to be a permanent home in any sense. First of all, I don't think it would have been if premium cable hadn't opened up, because I don't think I'm not particularly interested in writing around advertising and what that requires you to do in terms of, you know, making the audience complacent. So, I mean, I was going to have to tell darker stories, and those stories didn't really make it onto network television. They had to get rid of the advertisers first for television to in some way become a grown-up medium. So I didn't anticipate HBO. It just sort of arrived at the moment that I was standing there. So that was part of it. And then part of it was, yeah, listen, I didn't know, I can't tell one lens from another. I didn't know how the camera was supposed to move. I mean, I remember I was on set for 2 weeks, and I finally asked what the guy standing next to the camera turning the knob was doing. And they told me he was pulling focus, that was where the camera was focused. And I thought, you mean to tell me the guy looking through the lens doesn't focus the camera? How does that work? I mean, that was as ignorant as I was of just the basic equipment, the nomenclature of filming.
Wasn't Homicide shot differently? Wasn't there sort of a generational way that it was viewed filmed?
Levinson went back and shot it in 16 millimeter rather than 35. It was mostly handheld. Although, you know, as the show aged, they started laying more and more track. But even as they laid track, it was often to sit the cameraman with his camera on the shoulder.
But the handheld part of it was so very unique, correct?
Yeah, it was more of a throwback to Godard, kind of Breathless, that, you know, sort of French that was what they were sort of chasing, was that French neorealism type thing.
David, you mentioned, and I read this getting ready for your visit today, the difference between network TV and the streaming services. You also, in your remarks right now, you just said, I tell darker stories. And that gets to one of the criticisms that you must feel like you've answered 1,000 times. And it's reared its head again, obviously. And we're going to talk a lot about We Own This City. And yeah, I get questions from everybody knowing that you were coming on who's read that book. But the criticism that there goes David again, focusing on the dark and ugly of Baltimore, and that wherever we go, that's all people want to talk about is The Wire, and now it will be this We Own This City. What do you say in response to people that says David talks about the dark, ugly side of Baltimore?
And the drug war. You know, I'm not really writing about Baltimore. I mean, I know it's set in Baltimore. I know it has all the specific details of Baltimore. But I'm arguing about something larger, which is the dysfunction of the American drug war and what it's done to communities and families and people who've been prosecuted under it, but also to law enforcement. It's destroyed our police department here in Baltimore over 30, 40 years. I covered it. I watched it happen. Nobody in power has seen fit to arrest the problem or to direct any kind of meaningful reform. I'm sorry, but I was trained as a journalist. I don't work for the Greater Baltimore Committee. I'm not a civic booster. I am a Baltimorean. I live here. I'm talking to you from my office.
Not Hollywood, by the way. I love those.
Not Hollywood. I live here and I'm vested in the city's future, but the city's future is impaired at the point at which we continue to use our resources to do what we're doing policy-wise. The Wire, The Corner, and this piece, which is not my reporting, this is Justin Fenton. So obviously things have not gotten better in the 14 years, 15 years since I last shot film in Baltimore. I mean, I would point that out to you. The last four projects have been elsewhere.
Right.
So I went away. But Justin wrote this book, and it indicated that the things that we were arguing for in The Wire are still important. that they've not been heated. And in fact, things have gotten worse.
Well, let's start there, David, because God, there's so much just popping through my head. A question is, when you started on The Wire, I guess one of the questions is, in your wildest dreams, did you ever think it would, on every list that's ever published, it's listed as one of the greatest TV shows ever? Did, when you were working on it, did you feel that you were in the midst of something that was going to be immortalized like that?
No, I didn't think television had that kind of shelf life, unless you were sort of, you know, unless you were there at the beginning and you did The Honeymooners or something. You know, I didn't think anything had a shelf life of 20 years. We just wanted to finish. We wanted to like get our themes across, cover the ground we intended to cover, and hopefully the piece would stand and it would be an argument. The idea that it would actually grow became a source of almost absurdity to us. I mean, you got to remember, we were one of the first shows that had a continuing storyline. Instead of it being 22 or 12 episodes of short stories set in the same milieu, we were doing one storyline throughout each season, and effectively we were doing one overriding storyline through five seasons. So that was an ambition that could only be undertaken because HBO was showing the thing four, five, six times a week. It wasn't, you know, you catch it on Friday night or it's gone, which was the problem with network television, one of the problems with network television. Premium cable allowed you to catch it not at appointment viewing, but, you know, some point in the week when you felt like sitting down with the episode. And then they would show, you know, the first five episodes in a row 5 weeks in.
Right.
So they were trying to basically get around the idea of you had to schedule yourself to catch every episode. So maybe doing one whole storyline could work. We didn't anticipate box sets of seasons of television shows being a commodity, and we certainly didn't anticipate streaming being the inevitable end game for television. You know, it's now it's just TV's a lending library.
Well, so, David, to
finish.
Yeah.
So I mean, you know, to basically say, you know, we didn't anticipate that the medium could basically sustain itself as a lending library, that not everybody had to watch it right away, that basically people would find it. You know, nobody watched The Wire when it was on the air. They watched it in box sets of DVD, and then they watched it in streaming. And you know, there came a moment, I think 4 years, 5 years after it was off the air, where somebody, you know, showed me the sales figures on the box set of, you know, you just moved to half a million units of The Wire in 6 months. And it was like, to whom?
Right.
Who's buying
why
it now?
Why do you think that happened? What? I mean, do you have any rationale for how the butterfly flapped its wings and this happened to you?
It was word of mouth. It was just word of mouth. People who got to the end realized we had built something and then told their friends. And it happened first in Europe. That's sort of a little known thing in America, which is America's too diffuse. You know, there's just too many metro areas. There's too many people talking in isolation, in a sense, in a country of, you know, 360 million. In England, 40 million people, 20 million of which are oriented towards the greater London area, it exploded pretty quickly. Their word of mouth really effectively drove the box set. And The Wire became a hit in England before it was even remotely popular in the United States. How that happened is just, there's, you know, it wasn't like it had publicity over there. I mean, it had word of mouth.
The appeal of American injustice and chaos, like,
yeah, I guess dystopia plays better the further you get from America.
Right. You know? Well, without fail, David, affirming what you're saying, I have yet to be to Europe and run into someone and they say, "Where are you from?" And even though I live in Catonsville, like everyone else, I don't say Catonsville. Nobody knows. I say, "I'm from Baltimore." And inevitably they'll go, "The Wire." You know, they their first thought is, "Oh, I know that place, The Wire." So the European thing
is, if you said Catonsville, they'd ask you if you knew the band Talking Heads. So
they'd say Music City, Maryland. David Simon is our guest.
I was actually at Lansdowne High School when Mr. Byrne was there.
Oh, there you go, man. That's why your suits don't fit, maybe. David Simon is here. He is our guest. We're going to promote the current thing. So, David, I've wanted to have you on forever. So it's 31 years in. Thank you. I appreciate the time. And I think it's great that you have something successful that people talk about. I've never seen The Wire, famously. You're like Hemingway for me. I'm going to do it. I just didn't want to do it when I walked through the city every day. I've moved to the county about 3 months ago. And I'm moving more toward wanting to watch it and I mean, give myself 70 hours or however long it's going to take me, because it's going to be a chunk for me. And Don will tell you I haven't seen a movie.
Watch the damn show, dude.
Stop! I'm being honest.
So, I'm not going to be one of those people who hocks people to watch The Wire.
No, I want to.
I get on
if you want to watch.
No, I want to, and I feel like I must. I mean, people tell me. Everyone tells me I must. They're like, you're a Baltimore guy, you have to. And I'm like, I live here. Let me, get through. So, which brings me to now, right? So, in 2015, Freddie Gray happens, and I found a piece of yours. Now, I follow you, see you. No, I'm running you in a coffee shop in South Baltimore, and I have admiration for you. We have Raphael on the show. But you came back into my world, really, with this giant piece that you wrote after Freddie Gray about policing and overtime and courtroom, like all of this stuff that really opened my eyes. And I live downtown, own downtown, all of that. And then between there and here, we now have this crooked police thing that's become The Wire Part Two, or whatever people think it is at this point. But I would just say for Fenton to do this piece and you to find it, and for us to be living underneath of it in the modern era, speak to me about Fenton finding this thing, you at that point after Freddie Gray. What happened between there and here to get this thing made to television in a way that people are talking about it everywhere? Everybody's talking about this series right now.
Well, I mean, Justin and I go back a little bit. I mean, we talked about the beat. He has the same beat that I had. And obviously I maintain a casual interest as an ex reporter and at the Sun and an ex crime reporter. And Justin was, he obviously is a committed guy, and he's covering the beat really aggressively. And so when this scandal broke, and the feds started charging guys in the Gun Trace Task Force, I read Justin's articles contemporaneously, and I actually called him and said, Justin, this is a book. I mean, you need to write this as a book. And I gave him the name of my book agent. And then I called my book agent and said, there's a guy going to be calling you from the Baltimore Sun. Take the call and see if you can sell this, because he's sitting on a really remarkable scandal. And that's all I thought about. I didn't think about doing it as television. I really didn't. I had other projects in front, and I was busy trying to finish.
And this is maybe 18, 19. When did all that wrap up? I'm just trying to get a, because this has happened.
This is 17.
17. Okay, fair enough.
The coverage start. They start charging these guys in 17.
Yeah. For those listening, and somehow you've been out of the country or haven't been paying attention, Justin Fenton wrote a book, We Own This City, on the incredible abuse of the Baltimore City Police Department involving the Gun Trace Task Force. David Simon.
Really, all the plainclothes units. I mean,
it
extended. It extended back years, and a lot of these guys came up through a lot of the other plainclothes units.
Well, and David, one other question. And so you've got Wayne Jenkins. We're going to ask you what we've asked Justin several times. I've asked Jane Miller several times. So you got Wayne Jenkins. You got Danny Hursel, sort of the front and center of this piece, running this, what I'll call, crime syndicate. The question for you that I continue to grapple with is, who is Wayne Jenkins? What makes Wayne Jenkins tick, David?
I am honestly uninterested.
Okay.
In the same way that you might be. I mean, I think it's up to the actor and the writers to be interested when we're writing him on the page. But to me, he's basically just a creature of opportunity. And what's interesting to me about the piece is the systemic. I don't think... He's somebody of some considerable charisma, But I don't think that explains how long a leash he got and why he ran for so long on it and why he was able to do the things he did and why the people under him and over him.
Well, the systemic piece, David, I want you to talk more about it, because I tell you, this is the part that Nestor and I have struggled with, and maybe you'll be different in your response to this. I would tell you that the reporters and a lot of really good reporters who've covered this case have said to us, as hard as it is to believe, I don't believe the higher ups in the police department really knew the extent of what was going on. And Nestor and I have trouble with that.
They didn't. No, that's right. The reporters are correct. I mean, the fact that not knowing is the systemic disaster, which is they put these guys on the street and they heralded what they were doing as being valuable. Understand, this is about policy. This is about our priorities. It's what we spend our money and our treasure and our manpower on in Baltimore and nationally in terms of the drug war.
Well, it's about creating a statistic.
No, let me finish.
Okay,
you guys,
sure.
You ask me one question, I try to go for it, and you ask me another, I never get to the end of the answer. It's complicated, but think about this. There are two sets of skills in law enforcement. One of them is actually responding to crimes that hurt people and hurt communities, either trying to prevent those crimes or responding when they happen. Murder, rape, robbery, assault, car theft, burglary. These are the things, these felonies are the things that make a city untenable. To solve those things, you need skill sets involving, you know, how to use an informant, not be used by an informant, how to write a search and seizure warrant that'll hold up in court, how to testify in court and not perjure yourself, how to canvass, how to gather information, how to use the police computer effectively. There are skill sets to investigation that are comprehensive, and they need to be taught. They need to be rewarded. Well, for 40 years, the Baltimore Police Department rewarded guys for going up to the corner, jacking 20, 30 people up at a time, throwing them in wagons, giving this guy the ground stash. This guy gets two pills. This is how we make our stats. This is how I get paid at the courthouse. At the end of the month, I have 40 arrests. I look like I'm doing my job. The guy who maybe worked his post and found the one guy who was robbing people, he's got one arrest. He gets paid one time for going to court. So, and when it comes time to promote somebody, they promote the guy who doesn't know how to do police work, because the drug war has subsumed police work. So these guys come along, well, the Wayne Jenkinses and Herschels and Mamadou Gandous of the world, and they look like they are precious to the police department. They look like these are the guys who are really working. They're locking up the bad guys. No, they're not. They're going up to the corner and they're just gathering bodies. The bad guys continue to shoot and hurt and rob and abuse people in Baltimore with impunity. When I was a police reporter, the clearance rate for the homicide unit was 70%. That means about 40% of the people who shot and killed somebody actually saw the inside of a prison cell when it all shook out in court. Not great, but that it was better than the national average. The clearance rate now is 35%. Your chance of going to jail for shooting somebody in Baltimore is 1 in 10. The reason is we didn't validate that as police work. We validated this crap. And so these guys looked like they mattered, and they were paid, and they were promoted, and they got all the overtime, and they got all the road cars, and they were heralded as the heroes of the department. And the department, the brass just stood back and said, these are the guys that are putting guns and dope on the table, you know, for the press conference. Guns and dope. Well, that's crap. Guns and dope on the table are crap. Lock up a shooter, you've made the city appreciably safer. Guns and dope on the table are crap, but we have valued that for 40 years, and we've trained an entire generation of cops, two generations, in fact, how not to do the job. So these guys are endemic of what's gone wrong and why we have to end the drug war and why we have to take policing back to policing. And until we do that, nothing good is going to happen in Baltimore.
I would say when the Fenton stuff happened, I had read what you just said, what you just gave us in 3 minutes, was pretty much your 2015 piece after Freddie Gray that – open my eyes. Meanwhile, Wayne Jenkins is on the street that night doing this, right? And his crew,
right,
in that period. So 2 years later, when all this happens, I'm like, oh, it's almost like the stuff Simon wrote 2 years ago is actually come to life.
Freddie Gray, the Freddie Gray reality made these guys more valuable in the minds of the department, because after the indictment of the officers, and mark you, a case needed to be made against at least a negligence case. You know, you ride a guy around, depraved heart murder. I don't know about that charge, but you ride around, you take a guy in custody, you ride him around for 45 minutes. You don't check on him. He's in obvious distress in the back of your wagon, your jail van. And you don't check on him. There's a negligence case there that had to be made. If not criminally, should have been made criminally, but if not criminally, why did those guys manage to sail through the administrative? Why were they never punished for that? But so I'm not saying that, but to charge the arrest of Freddie Gray when I'm not saying it's the best police work in the world, but the three bike guys who charged him, they got him with a knife and they had sufficient probable cause, as a judge found, to have stopped him and detained him. And they got a knife. It was a pocket knife. It probably didn't matter. You can marginalize the arrest all you want, but you can't charge those guys criminally as our state's attorney did, because once that happened, and I'm not justifying this because it's terrible, but the rank and file basically went on strike. Arrests fell from 65,000 to about 38,000 very quickly in that first year. I think I have the numbers right. They certainly fell dramatically in the first 6 months after Freddie Gray. The police stopped getting out of their cars. Why would they? I mean, I don't agree with this. I think they should have, because it's their job. But from their point of view, from the point of view of the rank and file, they looked upon it as being, well, if I can go to jail for messing up an arrest, I'm not going to get out of my car. You know, this is a matter of, you know, determining the Fourth Amendment. The Supreme Court changes their mind about what the Fourth Amendment says every term. There's a new rule about when you can do a Terry stop or when you can do a stop and frisk. You know, why would I get out of my car and risk my career and my freedom to make an arrest? So basically, most of the police department started laying back after Freddie Gray. These guys, the Gun Trace Task Force and a lot of the other plainclothes units, they were out there to make money. They were still putting guns and dope on the table. They looked like the salvation for a police department to the brass, because most of these guys were not working anymore after Freddie Gray. And these guys looked like they were carrying the load for a police department that was back on its hind legs. And so they were treated to even less supervision, and they were given more authority more over time, and they advantage themselves of that.
David, early on in this interview, you said, hey, it's not just a Baltimore story. It's a story about our failure as a nation to deal with the drug issue nationwide. You talk about this systemic abuse in the Baltimore County, Baltimore City Police Department. What keeps cities and the structure of government from turning this thing around at all, even a little bit, like a battle? It's as Nestor said, we're Groundhog Day. We watch the same movie right over and over. What's getting in the way?
We do. We get in the way. We, the voters. On a fundamental level, there's not a sufficient plurality, never mind a majority, of Americans who won't fall for the next, shit spinning politician who says he's going to be tough on crime, or he's going to clear the drug corners, or he's going to find victory in the war on drugs. To go the opposite way from that and to basically say the drug war has been a failure, it's been a disastrous failure, it's taken our eyes off the prize of actual law enforcement, and it's trained police departments to do the wrong things. For a politician to say that is to risk being called weak on crime, and to be marginalized and to be primaried from the right so brutally that nobody does it. The last guy who tried it locally was a guy named Kurt Schmoke, who said the drug war is a failure. He said it in 1988. He was a prophet before his time, and he ended his political career for doing it. Now, would that have happened? There's probably less risk now because we've now endured another 30 years of disaster, and it's gotten to the, just gotten worse and worse. But I don't think it's a winning political argument with voters. Voters seem to be more motivated by fear than they are by logic. And if you say to a voter, look, fighting this war, drugs are as plentiful as ever. There's more drug corners than there were 30 years ago. The purity is higher. The Sacklers have millions. I mean, you've accomplished exactly nothing. And your police department now can't solve crime because you've trained them to do the wrong thing. If you tell them all that, they nod their head, and the next moment, the next moment when something scares them, something happens two blocks away, and they drive past a corner, there's three guys standing there that they don't know. They want them gone. and they want the politicians, you know, and they call, they pick up the phone and they call the police department and say, there's guys hanging out at the corner of whatever and whatever, get them out of my, you know, and they demand the same potholes be filled, and we're weak that way. And so we end up getting the government we deserve. You know, there's only that moment where most of us basically say, end this now, and we're going to vote for anyone who will do it, that it's going to end. You know, and I mean, there have been politicians who have come in at the national level who've tried to rationalize some of this. I mean, Kurt Schmoke in his second term told his AG, stop charging so many drug cases federally. Let's try to, you know, we're feeling that we have 2 million people a year. We have 2 million people in federal prison. This is insane. What are we doing? But, you know, that's not changing the law. And that's not actually leveling with the voters about what has to happen, because sure enough, he leaves office, Trump gets in, and Jeff Sessions is ready to lock everybody up just for having a bag of marijuana. So, you know, he flipped the switch the other way. I mean, this has to end. And how it ends is basically enough Americans stop being fooled. And you know, that's, you know, I've made some hours of television arguing the point, but, you know, if you make television shows expecting them to pass a better law, you'll be waiting a long time. So.
Well, that's where I was going to jump into this and saying you're making television about this. The part of you being a reporter and going to the Post and all that. I mean, Justin wrote a book. The book sells, but it is the television part of this that's going to tell the story to Europe and other places to illuminate the problem. Now you have to make a dramatization of this. And I want to tip the cap to you. You use a lot of Baltimore people. A lot. I had D on a couple of weeks ago. There's a lot of Baltimore in this, in your industry, not just telling Justin to write a book and all that, but people made money on this series here. You helped feed families in making this series here too. I want to make sure we point that out.
I mean, it's nice to have a film industry. You know, it's a roughly clean industry, and not everything is a crime story. Or not everything is as hard a crime story. But you know, that's, I mean, look, I don't know why dramatization somehow excites the imagination better than journalism, but it just does. It's a shame. The journalism should be sufficient for somebody to do the right thing, but it never seems to be. I mean, you know, I don't know what that is about the human mind or the human spirit, but you know, you put all the facts in front of us as America. I mean, look, we're a country who no longer can even recognize our own problems.
Right.
We don't govern ourselves very well anymore. We're really good at politics. We're really good at political machination and political rhetoric and hyperbolic rage. We're good at all that stuff. We just can't govern ourselves anymore. We can't recognize our own problems, much less solve any of them.
You captured that, David, and I know we have to run. I said to some, I ran into someone yesterday who had read the book and had not yet started the series. And I think I'm up to date on the series. Like you said, it's funny. I don't even know what night it comes out because I record it. So I think I'm up to date, but I said to someone, for some reason, your series on HBO, We Own This City, feels even more chaotic and tragic to me than Justin's book. And perhaps it's the concentration of the stories, perhaps it's the visualization of the stories, but there's a sense of chaos and hopelessness, which brings me to Sean Suter. You've introduced Sean. I know you have to make editorial decisions when you're bringing a book to screen. Do you end up at the end of the series when I see it? Do you take it all the way through Suter's suicide?
Yes, we do.
Do you draw any conclusions yourself as to what happened to Sean Suter?
I mean, you said it. He killed himself. All the physical evidence points to that. Points dramatically to that. The reasons to go to the, you know, there's a desire on the part of some people in Baltimore to go to a much more conspiratorial and exciting notion that he was assassinated by his fellow officers because he was going to testify for a grand jury. They didn't need his testimony. It was incredibly incremental. He was not the witness that was going to, most of these guys were already cooperating and pleading out. And the ones that weren't, the cases against them did not depend on Sean Suter. But more than that, and not to go through all the physical evidence at the scene, because Gary Childs, who's one of the best criminal investigators I ever saw yeah. my whole career.
Yes, he is.
Yeah, he went through it as an independent review of it, and his documentation of what's there and what's not there is masterful. But even on a basic level, I mean, just because we're pressed for time here, anybody who thinks that the police assassinated Sean Souter has to ask themselves this question and then confront their own insanity. If you are some Machiavellian cop who's trying to prevent one of your fellow officers from testifying against you and you need to assassinate him, why in hell would you take him to an alley in West Baltimore and fight him for his own gun? Why is that your scenario? Think about it for half a second and then be embarrassed that you're arguing this. If you're trying to make it look like Sean Souter is killed on the street, you're not trying to make it look like you assassinated. You don't want to draw attention to yourself. You're already on trial for your life. You don't want to kill a federal witness. So if you're going to kill a federal witness, what are you going to make it look like is, hey, he was out on the street. Baltimore's a dangerous place. Somebody shot him. You walk up to him with a gun that's not your own. That's not your service weapon. You shoot him. You walk away. You shoot him dead. You walk away. You throw the gun in a sewer and you're done. The idea that you're going to go into an alley and fight another healthy cop for his gun. What if you lose? What if you end up losing that fight for the gun? Why introduce all of that insane variable of what's going to happen if I try to battle this guy to shoot him with his own gun, which is what happened to Sean Souter ballistically? Why would you do that if that is that people have managed to construct a police assassination out of that scenario is an embarrassment to conspiracy theory. And yet, you know, there are people who, for their own reasons, wanted to do so. And there are people who wanted to make it ambiguous as if, yes, maybe he was a hero who had been shot just trying to do police work on the street. You know, the police commissioner who had locked down a neighborhood for a week and was confronted by the breath of the gun trace scandal. You know, he wanted to open the door to the idea that this might have been a hero's death, but he had his other reasons. But once you start examining all of the evidence, you know, where's the radio? Where's the gun? Where's the, you know, the blood on the inside of the car? It's so obvious. It's just an embarrassment that Baltimore got to this point. So,
well, David,
I hate to ruin the great mystery of Sean Souter, but there is no mystery.
No, and every reporter we've spoken again to a number of really top notch reporters, many of whom are your friends, who've reviewed that evidence as you have in detail. And they've all told me, Don, there's no other ending. It's Sean Souter, as Gary Child said, committed suicide. A very tragic figure.
Yeah, he was going to be named by the other officers as having taken money earlier in his career. It was a tragedy. The past reached up and it caught Detective Souter, and he took an extreme method of trying to maintain his status and his circumstance and on some level deliver a pension to his family. It's very tragic and I'm very sorry for the family, but truth is truth here.
David Simon, it's taken a long time to get you on. I appreciate it. And you know, this is heavy matter and we all live here. We're all trying to make the place better. And I will watch The Wire when I have the 60%. Believe me, I'm going to watch The Wire. I have to, I must, I need to. Hey man, thank you for the time. And thanks for making the great stuff you do.
Thanks for having
and
me on.
Thanks great for entertaining work. The hell out of me on Twitter. Hey man, I got it for you if you need it. I mean, I got it right here. I make copies for you.
All
right?
I know all the words. I know all the words.
You've used them once or twice.
Appreciate you. David Simon.
Thank you, David.
We own The City's Own HBO. Please go watch it. And my wife and I are getting some popcorn for it, quite frankly, right about now. We know we need to see it. I am Nestor. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore, and we never stop talking. Baltimore positive.